From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Actor Peter Coyote came to movies relatively late, but he came to anarchy early. On this edition of Fresh Air, the co-star of E.T., Jagged Edge, and Outrageous Fortune tells us about his radical street theater in the 60s with the celebrated Haight-Ashbury collective, The Diggers. Also today, Tony Williams remembers his days as a jazz prodigy. He became Miles Davis's drummer at the age of 17 and went on to become a star of jazz fusion. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from a couple of bands known for their sense of humor, Was Not Was and Too Much Joy. And book critic John Leonard reviews Hocus Pocus, the new novel by Kurt Vonnegut. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. and Saudi officials announced today that Saudi Arabia has committed several billion dollars toward the cost of the U.S. troop buildup in the kingdom. The commitment came in response to a direct appeal from Secretary of State James Baker, who held lengthy meetings with the Saudi foreign minister and King Fahd. U.S. officials say that the commitment means that the Saudis will, at the minimum, pay for the fuel, water, and transportation costs of the troops now in Saudi Arabia. Earlier this week, Secretary Baker estimated the U.S. deployment will cost about $6 billion by the end of the year. The White House has announced that President Bush will accept an Iraqi offer to deliver a taped speech for broadcast on Iraqi television. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater told reporters on board Air Force One that the U.S. had not directly heard from the Iraqis, but that the invitation had been issued by the Iraqi Information Minister. He said the president will tape a message in the next few days and send it to the Iraqi Information Minister. Fitzwater said he expected the broadcast would be aired sometime next week. The spokesman was asked whether the administration was concerned that the Iraqis might edit or censor the taped message. He replied, "We take them at their word." The invitation to address the Iraqi people followed Saddam Hussein's statements on American TV, saying he wanted to debate President Bush on the Persian Gulf crisis. The president rejected that offer last week. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
French President François Mitterrand said today that his country will intervene militarily if Iraq attacks any other country in the Persian Gulf. But he said that French forces wouldn't automatically join a U.S. attack on Iraq. Mitterrand said that unless there's new Iraqi aggression, France would confine itself to enforcing the UN embargo against Iraq. Mitterrand told reporters that he spoke by telephone today with both President Bush and Soviet President Gorbachev. NASA officials said today that the space shuttle could be flying within 2 weeks. A hydrogen leak discovered last night had forced the space agency to scrub this morning's planned liftoff. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Data collected from sensors aboard the shuttle Columbia led NASA officials to believe that the latest fuel leak to plague the shuttle program can be repaired relatively quickly. Managers said this afternoon that the leak appears to be coming from a recirculation pump within the shuttle's maze of plumbing. A spare pump is on site at the Kennedy Space Center, and officials will begin repair work Saturday. Workers are expected to enter the aft main engine compartment sometime this evening to begin physical inspection of the leak area. If everything goes according to NASA's repair timeline, officials say launch could be rescheduled for as early as September 17th. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 32 points today to close at 2,596.29. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Peter Coyote is best known for his roles in E.T., Jagged Edge, and Outrageous Fortune. He didn't start acting in films until his late 30s. Until then, the theater he participated in was radical street theater. Coyote was a member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and he was a digger. The Diggers were one of the most celebrated collectives of the 60s. They ran a free store and handed out free food daily in Golden Gate Park. Coyote says this period continues to be trivialized and misunderstood, so he's writing his own memoir of the times. And he just wrote an introduction to a new edition of Ringolivio, a memoir by the late Emmett Grogan of the Diggers. Ringolivio is part of a new series of books called Citadel Underground, which is bringing some of the classic works of the 60s counterculture back into print. Part of the distorted view of the 60s can be attributed to Peter Coyote's current employer, Hollywood. Coyote will be the first to tell you, films about that time just never seemed to get it right. He almost directed a sequence in one of the classic 60s films, Easy Rider, but the negotiations with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda fell through at the last minute.
These guys assumed that we were all kind of flower children or something. So when Peter and Dennis offered me $20 a week and to sleep on their couch to do this film, we passed. And I had hoped to put a bunch of really hungry actors to work. And so they put a sequence in Easy Rider of a guerrilla theater troupe, spelled G-O-R-I-L-L-A, bunch of old hookers and people of dubious sexual persuasion mincing around in tights, which I took great affront to. And that film in particular seemed to suggest that if you lived the way that my friends and I were living, you were going to get killed by some redneck in the South. And aside from the splendor of getting Jack Nicholson in that film, everything else about it was totally wrong. And that just seems to be the way, you know, when you bring a lot of money in and when you try to do an artistic restatement of something, the multiplicity of life gets squeezed down to a single point of view. Well, and something gets cockeyed in it.
This idea of offering you $20 a week and a couch to sleep on, do you think that people thought just because you had run free stores and given away free food that you'd be perfectly happy to work for free?
I think so. Or, you know, I mean, it took a lot of money and a lot of energy to live free. I have to point that out. And the diggers were pretty mysterious about how and where we got that money. And we did that for a reason. And usually we would give away any money that was given to us in front of the people who gave it to us.
Peter Coyote is my guest. In your introduction to Ringolivio, you describe yourself and the people who you were with during the 60s as life actors. Now, as someone who is a professional actor now, what do you mean by life actor?
Well, it occurred to a number of us one day that we were writing these plays to excoriate the politics of the middle class, and they were giving us medals. We had won an Obie in New York in 1967, and it occurred to us that theater was not going to be a vehicle for radical change, because when you paid admission at the door, you knew in your deepest bone marrow that it was a business. And if you didn't like the conclusions or the point of view that was put forward on the stage, it was like going into a store where you didn't like the merchandise. You just left. Nothing really challenged the question of storeness. Should there be a store at all? So we thought, what would happen if we would take our same aesthetic impulses and imagination and improvisatory abilities and play them out in real life and use situations as props to try to enlighten people to cultural alternatives that were not available, and to do it theatrically, but in a way in which no one could claim it was theater, where it was real life, and people had to come up and look at their responses as in the same way that they would look at themselves in everyday life. So we tried to create situations where we and the other people involved were thrown in over their heads, where they were forced into new situations, like a free store. You go into a store, and not only are all the goods free, but so are the roles. So someone might come and ask for the manager, and the response would be, well, you're the manager, what shall we do today? And you keep playing around with them until they take it seriously, and at which point they become the manager. They get to try out their idea of what a free store might be, and everyone in the store will go along with it. So that would be an example of life acting.
It seems to me that the idea of life acting also covered your own identities. I mean, a lot of the people in The Diggers, I think, recreated themselves. You know, Emmick Grogan had been Eugene Grogan. You had been Peter Cohan. Am I pronouncing that right? And, I mean, you found new names for yourselves and, in a way, I think, new identities as well. Is that right?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, my relationship to my name was, I would say, more religious than political. But I definitely think it's true that when you grow up in a culture, your reality or your identity is circumscribed by that culture. There are certain options that are open to you. You know, Peter Cohan was this kind of a person, and he had these kind of expectations welded onto his identity. And at a certain point, if you want to break into new territory, you have to leave that identity behind. It's not necessary to do that or necessary to rename yourself, but it was something that was current then, and it seemed to function as a useful tool to give people the freedom to reinvestigate their choices and their decisions and their assumptions.
In the Diggers and in the San Francisco Mime Troupe, did you all know each other's original selves, or did you only know each other by your newer identities?
Well, things are not so clear-cut, are they? I mean, the fundamental insight of Buddhism is that there is no original self. There's nobody home. So on some level, you look at people as a constellation of actions and impulses and intentions and decisions. And so what we saw were these constellations in transition. You saw simultaneously the people we each wanted to be, the people we were, and the people we were struggling against. And that's what made it a particularly fascinating time and kind of what bonded us all so deeply, because nobody was purely anything. We were all trying to reinvent a culture and to come in contact with an idea of an untrammeled personal authenticity. And it was a difficult thing to do.
Was there a part of yourself that you felt, or your own background that you were struggling against?
You mean me personally?
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up with a lot of expectations about the right ways of doing things. For a period in my life, my family had a lot of money, and I knew that I was being deprived of true tests of my worth. I was being sheltered by this money and by certain kinds of privilege. And so that was something that I wanted to find out who I was and to test myself against the same standards that people without privilege faced. And that meant you had to go to some kind of free territory where your address or your name was meaningless. You couldn't live in the same town. If the cops stopped you and asked where you lived and you gave an address on Booth Avenue, you were going to be treated differently than a black kid who lived on 2nd Street. It was built into the system. So I think that's one reason why a lot of kids who were really serious about getting in touch with their authenticity fled to the free territories of the Lower East Side and Berkeley and Haight-Ashbury, because it was a place where you would be taken for who you were and how you behaved, and you would pay real dues.
Did you ever feel that if somebody found out about your background, that you had been from a privileged background, your father, I think, had been president of a railroad company and an oil company, that it would be a way of dismissing you? You know, like, well, sure, he's working at a free store, but he's from a privileged background.
No, I was never afraid of that. I had a problem. For instance, in the 60s, we had no money, and we lived in a very impoverished fashion. And yet my personal standards of excellence and elegance were groomed by the best museums and best art and access to a heightened spectrum of possibilities. And so I had a lot of ideas about elegance and excellence and standards that I had to sort through. How was I going to live without money and still manifest my idea of living up to certain standards of mind, not of wealth or value, but just standards of achievement or order of mind? How was I going to do that? So, for instance, I lived in this truck, but my truck was fastidious. You know, it was beautifully painted, and everything was repaired, and everything was stowed in little boxes and little tchotchkes and this and that. And a lot of people did that. And I was not a very good craftsman. Some of the gypsy truckers that I lived with were cabinet makers, and their trucks were works of art. They were impeccable.
One of the things that the Diggers became really well known for was free stores, giving out free food. I remember I was living in Buffalo in 1969 and 1970, and there was a free store there, and I remember once it was ripped off. And it's like, what does it mean when a free store is ripped off? Did you ever go through a little kind of a crisis of confusion about that?
No, it was... It was a crisis of humor. I thought it was fabulous coming to work in the free store one day, and it was a big, kind of large black woman who was furtively shoving clothes in a paper bag. And I went over equally furtively, and I kept watch, and I would shove things into the bag, and pretty soon we were in collusion, and we were jamming things into this paper bag, and she leaned over to me, and she said in kind of a throaty whisper, where's the boss? And I said, I'm the boss. And she looked at me stunned, and I said, it's a free store. And she just stopped. She just didn't know what to do. I said, it's a free store. It's yours. She said, everything? I said, my job. She said, your job? I said, yeah. Then she said, get out of my face. So I just walked away. And she just blatantly went around the store and collected what she needed and left. So that was a piece of theater for her and for me.
When you were serving, say, free food at large gatherings, did you ever go through feeling, this is really great, but I don't really want to be preparing or serving food?
Yeah, so you'd stop. One of the great things about the Diggers, I was never interested in the free food.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it just didn't interest me for a little while. But the Diggers had no ideology. Everything was based on personal authenticity. And it was also kind of, we were kind of a reproach to the left. We felt that the left was always hiding behind ideology. We can't do this till after the revolution. Gee, if it wasn't for multinational corporations, we could such and such. And our attitude was, you know, do it. If you have an idea, do it. Create the condition you describe, as Peter Berg used to say. And so somebody thought, gee, all these kids are coming to San Francisco. The city's making a mint off tourists coming to the Haight-Ashbury. The merchants are trying to get rid of the kids. The city's trying to get rid of them. Somebody's got to feed them because they're here. So Emmett and a bunch of people wanted to do that, and they did it. Along the way, they turned it into a mechanism to create this idea of a free frame of reference, making people step through a huge yellow frame of 2x4s to get the food, and then giving them these little frames to wear around their necks to invite them to look at the world from a free frame of reference. But other people had completely different ideas. Somebody wanted to take a flatbed truck of black conga drummers and naked belly dancers down Montgomery Street at rush hour and invite the stockbrokers to get on board and change their lives. And they did that.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actor Peter Coyote, and he's been in such films as Jagged Edge, E.T., Outrageous Fortune, and Southern Comfort. Coyote has just written the introduction to a new edition of Emmett Grogan's autobiography, Ringolivio, A Life Played for Keeps. It's in part about the Diggers. It's part of a new series of books called Citadel Underground, which includes reissues of some classic books of the American counterculture of the 60s. This is Fresh Air. Peter Coyote is my guest. In your introduction to Emmett Grogan's book that's just been republished, Ringolivio, you tell the story of how he shot you up once with heroin and said, this will really change you. Did he ask for your permission to do that? Did you want him to do that?
Yeah, I did. Seems insane, doesn't it? No, I wasn't tied down. I was a willing participant. You know, heroin, lots of people were into psychedelics, and there was an aspect of psychedelics that was turning out this kind of blissful, sexless, nirvana businessman, these kind of long-haired hippie merchant elite, you know, who really had no interests outside their own pocketbooks and appearing stylish. And heroin was there as, you know, the ally of Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday. And the line I used in the book was all of those people who had turned themselves into the flames that they signaled through. And it was just an option to try to find a new place in your consciousness that wasn't domesticated. Unfortunately, it was an option that didn't let you go so easily.
Well, how many times did you do it?
How many times did I do it?
Yeah. I mean, did you just shoot up once, or did you?
Oh, please, no.
Oh, no? Oh, okay. I wasn't sure.
Too much fun.
Oh, okay.
No, I wasn't sure. I did it until it was very hard to stop.
I see. Okay. Peter Coyote is my guest. And, you know, we were talking about how you had this, like, old and new identity. And I think they came together in a way when your father died. You went back with some of your friends from the Diggers. You went back to your mother's place to help her, I guess, recover from the death and also recover from the debt that your father had left her in. Was that an unusual experience to have the two worlds, the world of your family and the world of your friends, brought together for a while?
Boy, that was completely schizophrenic. I was never more out of my depth in my life. I went back and I was in this truck with wooden sides and a canvas cover. My mom was widowed. My dad had been a partnership, not a corporation. So everything was up for grabs, cattle ranches and homes and businesses, and it was millions of dollars in debt, and the creditors were literally pulling at her over the coffin. And the business had run through a huge land sale in about 10 days, and my mom was going to be on the street, and nobody was really helping her at all. So I walked into a barber shop one day, and I cut my hair. All I could sit on it. The barber couldn't believe this. I cut my hair. I borrowed a suit from my mom, $150. I bought a suit. And we got all the creditors together. And basically I said, I've come back from the coast to be a rich and famous capitalist. And unless you absolve us of debt, interest on debt, which at that time was about $385,000 a year, I'm going to close the business and you'll get a nickel on the dollar. So they did that for a year. And I went into New York, and I became a registered representative in 10 days. I became a stockbroker. And my father's salesman, of course, had stolen all his customers, and they gave me a book about 4 inches thick with the name of every company that employed two or more people in the state of New York. And I started making blind phone calls 8 hours a day. Hi, I'm calling from Mars Cohen and Company. We'd like to sell you the opportunity to desecrate Hawaii for $12 a share. And I did this. Then, because my daughter's mother at that time and my mother were not getting along, I moved up to the family farm, and she couldn't stay by herself. And so various friends from California came by, and we basically replicated one of our communes on the family farm. So Monday morning, I would get up and I would go to Wall Street by bus, and I'd stay in the city till Thursday afternoon. And then I'd get off the bus, I'd change into my work clothes, and I'd do farm work because our old neighbor had broken his back, and we were milking 60 of his cows and making hay and doing all this stuff for him for barter, you know, a ton of potatoes and 9 pigs. And so I would do manual labor Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then get back on the bus and go into New York. And I think that in the 10 months that I did that, I probably sold 2 stocks. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was never more out of my depth. And although I did manage to get my dad's insurance money for my mom, which she basically lives on today. She went out and got a job in her 60s, her first job in 40 years maybe. So it was a very, very surreal time. And, of course, my mother didn't understand these crazy people, and neither did all the people in this little town in Pennsylvania that I'd grown up in. All of a sudden, all these crazy people are around, you know, with long hair and funky trucks, and they're living in the outbuildings. And instead of being this showplace farm that was funded from all this Wall Street theft, it was turning into a large hippie artifact. And it was a very, very bizarre time.
Oh, boy, it sounds really crazy.
We ultimately lost the farm. We were all evicted, and that's all she wrote. It was 35 years of work on my dad's part.
Wow. Peter Coyote is my guest. How did you go from the life you were living to acting in Hollywood movies?
Well, I came back after we lost the farm. I came back to California, and at the same time, Gary Snyder, one of my old friends, won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry, and the governor of California appointed him chairman of a new arts council, state arts council, he was going to form. And Gary asked me to join, and he said it would be an opportunity to define the state. I couldn't pass it up. And although we made a lot of mistakes initially, the next year I was elected chairman, And I was chairman for almost 3 years, and during that time raised the budget from $1 to $13 million annually. And to do that, had to make pretty broad political coalitions and had to co-opt a lot of right-wing legislators. And we gradually won their respect, and we made programs that were picked up and copied on the national level. And I was so good at it that I realized that I didn't really need to stay a prince in a kingdom of my own making, that I could talk to lots of different people. And I realized that I'd always had this secret yen to try the movies. I mean, if you're an actor, that is the big time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been prevented from doing that, really, by Digger ideology of anonymity and free. And so I was just winding up sticking needles in my arm. That didn't seem like a real healthy alternative. And so I decided to try it. So about 1978, I threw myself back into theater, and I worked 2 solid years at the Magic Theater. I did the world premiere of True West there, and 2 other premieres, one by Michael McClure called The Red Snake, another called Autobiography of a Pearl Diver by Martin Epstein, another one called Charles the Irrelevant, which was written for me. And I became kind of one of the hot young actors in San Francisco. And on the basis of that, I had a local agent, and she set me up for a number of meetings to go to L.A. And I met 16 casting directors. And I was about 38 by this time. I mean, I was too young to fool around, so I got pretty organized. And I kept a file card on each person I met. And if we talked about a book or a poem or a newspaper article, when I got home, I wrote them all a thank you note that was jotted on the card, and I sent the article. And then every month, I'd just write him a letter, a little note with my reviews or what I was doing. And after about 7 months of that, an agent called me out of the blue, a guy named Andy Friedman. And in September of 1990, this will be 10 years in the film business.
It's funny, don't you think, that many of the roles you're best known for are roles in which you've played, say, a government agent in E.T. or a district attorney in Jagged Edge, just exactly the kind of people who you haven't been.
Well, I think there's a kind of cultural bias that equates intelligence with malevolence. And I don't know why that is, but if the script says smart and evil, I'll get it. If the script says gorgeous and sexy, they'll send it to Kevin Costner. I don't know what it is. I think that it's that I have an ability to translate complex people. And to humanize some of these people that might otherwise be just stereotypes. And so I get called on to do that. The only problem with that is that unless you get the girl, you don't really get the power and the authority and the money. But I certainly am having a good time being an actor, and I can't complain because it's such an unstable occupation. There are so many people that would envy my problems.
Do you feel that you've become the person you wanted to be?
No, I think I'm still working at it. I haven't found the edges, you know, and I much prefer the surprise and the invisibility of constantly looking.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on Fresh Air.
Actor Peter Coyote, he has 3 films coming out in the next 6 months, including Crooked Hearts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Albie Sachs, a white member of the legal department of the African National Congress. In 1988, he survived a car bomb that was intended to kill him. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When jazz drummer Tony Williams started playing club dates with the Miles Davis Quintet, he was still too young to sit at the bar. He put in 6 years with Miles, then formed one of the first fusion bands. But a few years ago, he returned to jazz. Coming up, Tony Williams talks about growing up playing drums. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Was Not Was and Too Much Joy, two bands that share an ironic view of contemporary life. And best-selling writer Kurt Vonnegut has a new novel. Book critic John Leonard reviews Hocus Pocus. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Saudi Arabia has pledged several billion dollars to help pay for the buildup of U.S. military forces in the Persian Gulf area. U.S. officials say, at the very least, Saudi Arabia will pay for all fuel, water, and transportation expenses for U.S. troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Baker is now in the Middle East and meets tomorrow with Kuwaiti leaders overthrown by the Iraqi invasion. Today in Washington, Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy expressed confidence that the U.S. will forgive Israel's military debt if Washington forgives Egypt's military debt, as President Bush has proposed. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
After a brief meeting with President Bush at the White House, Levy told reporters, "From the moment we entered the Camp David peace process, aid to Egypt is absolutely linked to aid to Israel." And Levy added, "I hope and I am convinced that there will not be a different attitude toward us as compared to the one toward Egypt." Capitol Hill sources say it's unlikely that Egypt's military debt will be forgiven without Israel's being forgiven too. Egypt owes about $7 billion, Israel about $4.5. Arab sources say it is essential for Egypt's debt to be forgiven. Egypt has incurred huge costs by sending troops to defend Saudi Arabia and by absorbing tens of thousands of Egyptian refugees from Iraq and Kuwait. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Jordan's King Hussein returned today from a trip to Baghdad, where he briefed Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein on his efforts to come up with a peaceful settlement to the Persian Gulf crisis. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The Jordanian government said tonight that the king reported to Saddam Hussein on the reaction European leaders had to Jordanian proposals for ending the Gulf conflict. In the past 2 weeks, King Hussein visited 10 countries in North Africa and Western Europe, trying to win support for a political settlement of the Gulf crisis. According to diplomats, the king is promoting a plan under which Western forces would withdraw from Saudi Arabia simultaneous with the withdrawal of Iraqi forces from Kuwait, with an Arab peacekeeping force moving in to separate the hostile sides. Western leaders gave the Jordanian plan a cool reception, even while welcoming the king's efforts to avert war. Upon his return from Iraq today, the king had no comment on Saddam Hussein's latest thoughts. Jordanian officials said only the two men discussed prospects for a peaceful solution of the crisis. In Amman, I'm Tom Gelton.
President Mitterrand of France says his country will intervene militarily if Iraq attacks any other country in the Persian Gulf region, but will not automatically join a U.S. attack on Iraq. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 32 points to close at 2,596.29 on volume of some 126 million shares. Trading was light. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, book critic John Leonard reviews Kurt Vonnegut's new novel, Hocus Pocus. But first, the band Was Not Was was created by a couple of guys from Detroit. The band Too Much Joy is made up of four fellows from the suburbs of New York. Each band has an offbeat sense of humor. They also both have new albums. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
She might be working over at the other store. I haven't seen her in a whole month. Are you a friend of hers or what?
The pleasures and pitfalls of making humorous rock and roll come through loud and clear on the new releases by Was Not Was and Too Much Joy.
Was Not Was is masterminded by David Weiss and Don Fagenson, who call themselves Don and David Was. The Was boys really like to mix things up. Straight rhythm and blues and rock tracks sit next to stuff influenced by cult artists such as Captain Beefheart and Sun Ra. One trademark of every Was Not Was album is a ranting musical monologue by David Was. On Are You OK?, that song is called I Feel Better Than James Brown.
I was attending Mardi Gras with Fidel Castro. Buxom cross-dressers threw fake gold coins at our feet as we discussed the fate of the revolution. Suddenly, CIA men dressed in bikinis tried to stab us with fountain pens. Fidel blew mustard gas through his cigar and immobilized a lot of them. 19 tequilas later, we had a deal. Havana goes back to the mob, and Fidel and I open a chain of Kentucky Fried Chicken shops. Ain't life sweet? I feel good. I feel better than James Brown. I feel better now. I feel better than James Brown. I feel better now. How do you feel?
Sometimes, as on that cut, Was Not Was seems to be straining for an appealing peculiarness, a homegrown surrealism that isn't quite as funny as the band probably intends. In fact, this is the first Was album in which the straightforward conventional songs are better than their weird stuff. The best example of this is the album's first single, a terrific version of the Temptations' old hit, Papa Was a Rolling Stone, updated for the hip-hop music of the 90s.
And I'm praying, wishing and hoping my dreams could come true, so I could feel like the other kids do. A young child, but not complete as a whole. Before I was born, you're up and strolled. Mama was there, but you was up in the wind. You never even knew my name, and then you never wrote, called, let alone came by. As a youth, it was hard to wonder why. But now I'm older, and I don't dwell in self-pity, thinking about the life you didn't give me.
By now, Was Not Was or old prose, at least compared to a quartet of Scarsdale, New York upstarts called Too Much Joy. Like Was Not Was, they're eclectic jokers and compulsive wise guys, but they're also wise guys with a conscience, as they prove on a song called Making Fun of Bums. Too Much Joy, despite that defense of the homeless, likes to invite accusations of adolescent obnoxiousness. Dr. Seuss fans, offended by their twisting of a Seuss phrase for the title of this album, Son of Sam I Am, should also know that the group called its debut release Green Eggs and Crack. Sophomoric jokes aside, however, these guys can be really funny. Their greatest achievement in this area so far is their terrific version of a rap tune by LL Cool J. It's called That's a Lie.
I love you.
Weeks ago, Too Much Joy carried its love of rap music to a noble extreme. These smart alecks went down to the nightclub in Florida where two live crew had been arrested for rapping their obscene compositions. Too Much Joy had rearranged a bunch of Two Live Crew raps, emphasizing the melodies and turning them into rock and roll. After the show, they were promptly arrested for obscenity. Lead singer Tim Quirk said, "We wanted to prove that it doesn't matter whether you're black or white. The First Amendment is dead in Florida." Sometimes even funny guys have to get serious.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
I've been a butcher, I've been a baker, I have been a bookmaker. I have skippered clipper ships and dug for undertakers.
This is Fresh Air. Tony Williams was 17 when he became the drummer for the Miles Davis Quintet in 1963. He was soon one of the most admired drummers of his time. 6 years later, he left the band and formed one of the first jazz fusion groups. It featured John McLaughlin on electric guitar. In the mid-80s, Williams returned to acoustic jazz and formed a band that had the same configuration as the Miles Davis Quintet. Williams composed all the pieces on his new album, Native Heart. This is City of Lights.
This type of band, quintet with trumpet, saxophone, bass and drums, and piano, I never had a band like this. So it was a challenge for me to put a band like this together. I thought it was time for me to start using a lot of tools that I had gained. I'd started studying composition in 1980, and this seemed to be a good way to see what I had learned.
Why did you want to study composition? You'd already been writing for many years.
Well, I had been, but I never felt comfortable. I never felt that I had a grasp of the craft of writing music. So I wanted to take some of the mystery out of some of the mystery from some of the things that I found myself running up against every time I tried to write a piece of music.
The publishing company that you use to copyright your songs, to publish your songs, Tillman Music, that's named after your father?
Yes, it is, actually, huh?
Now, he played saxophone.
Right, right.
Is that how you were introduced to jazz?
Actually, yeah. Well, he was always playing jobs when I was a child, and he would take me with him, like babysitting. And I got a chance to be introduced to the music and the way of life of a musician.
When you were very young in Boston, you would occasionally sit in with Art Blakey's band or Max Roach's band. How did you get to do it? Did you ask them? Did you go up to them and ask?
Well, actually, it was my dad. He would go and I guess, pester these people and tell them about his son. And then, he'd ask them if I could meet, you know, if I could meet them. And then he'd call me up and say, hey, son, come on down. Max Roach is here, and I want you to meet him, or Art Blakey. So it was my dad.
And then he'd ask if you could sit in?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it ever embarrassing? Did you feel that your father was being pushy?
Oh, no, no, not at all. Not at all. No. I tell you, my dad was a very... Actually, the first time I played a drum set was in front of an audience one night. And the remarkable thing was I went up to my father. I said, Dad, can I play on the next set? And immediately he said, yes. Then he said, what instrument do you want to play? So he was that kind of, he is that kind of guy. You know, he's a pretty open person.
When you were 16, you left Boston to go to New York to play with Jackie McLean's band.
Right.
Did you drop out of high school for that? Had you already left high school?
I had already left high school. Yeah.
Why did you leave?
It was 1961, 62 at that time. And there was no music in the school I was attending, and I was very bored, and I was having a lot more fun playing music with a lot of great musicians.
What were what was the range of attitudes toward you that musicians showed? I mean, did you get admiration, but also some condescension or jealousy from more mature musicians who realized how talented and how young you were?
Well, yeah, you could say that, you know, but I was always looking for I looked for the best in people, so I kind of concentrated on the older musicians who were very generous and very kind, like Cannonball Adderley and Art Farmer and Louis Hayes and Jimmy Cobb.
What did they do for you?
Well, they talked to me. They weren't weird. They were the kind of guys that helped me understand that you don't have to be eccentric to be an artist. You can be a very regular person.
Now, you joined Miles Davis Band when you were 17.
Right.
How did he hear you?
He heard me with Jackie McLean, fortunately.
What was Miles Davis's way of communicating to the musicians in the band what he wanted?
Oh, boy, that's difficult to answer. You see, Miles hires people because they play really well, which is the way it should be. And he doesn't really have to tell you a whole lot because he really trusts the people that he's hired because they play really well. So he gives you a lot of room to explore things.
Why you decided to leave the Miles Davis group?
I had been with him 6 years, and I wanted to move on. I wanted I used to think to myself, if I leave now, I'll be still young enough to make all the mistakes I know I'm going to make and probably have the resiliency to bounce back. So that had a lot to do with it.
You formed your own band after you left. And your band, well, your lifetime band, was one of the very early fusion bands. Tell me what you were thinking about when you formed that band, which had, you know, John McLaughlin on electric guitar. I mean, this is one of the early instances of kind of plugging in,
yeah.
You know, in a jazz band. What were the things going through your mind at that time?
Well, I tell you, I had just, Well, I had left Miles Davis's band, and I knew I wanted to put a band together that was different than that, you know, meaning trumpet, saxophone, piano, bass, and drums. And I had been listening a lot at the time to Jimi Hendrix and Cream and the Beatles and bands like that. So I knew I wanted to put an electric band together. And one of the elements that I had always enjoyed was an organ, the old blues kind of organ trio. I had played a lot with Johnny Hammond Smith in Boston. So that gave me a great idea to put an electric band together playing a certain type of rock beats with a sort of jazz melodies.
Remember the first time that you played in a band where there was someone younger than you were?
The first time I played in a band with someone that was younger?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I guess that was in 1975. I had a band, another Lifetime band, with Alan Holdsworth and Tony Newton and Alan Pasqua. I think that was about the first time.
And how did it make you feel to not be the youngest in the band anymore?
It was strange. It was difficult to get used to. But it was a milestone because all my life I'd always been the youngest and the smallest.
Are there often 12-year-old musicians who want to sit in with you and assume that you'll be willing to let them sit in since musicians did that for you when you were young?
No, that's... I haven't had that happen yet. I'm waiting. But no, it hasn't. It doesn't happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. Thank you for inviting me.
Tony Williams' new album, Native Heart, is on Blue Note Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news of the crisis in the Persian Gulf today, including President Bush's acceptance of the Iraqi invitation to make a speech on Iraqi television, and also word of an American who was shot and wounded, it seems, in Kuwait. Also, talk with a Soviet economist about how the Soviet Union might be able to step in and provide more oil to the United States, oil from Siberia. A talk with writer Carrie Fisher about her new novel and the movie that's been made of her first novel. And also, we'll talk with a gentleman who offers a fascinating service. He sells plastic molds with which you can grow vegetables that'll look just like you.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The novels of Kurt Vonnegut take place all over the space-time continuum. His new novel, Hocus Pocus, goes from West Point to Vietnam to upstate New York in the year 2001. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
When I'm feeling as bad as he does, it seems to me that Kurt Vonnegut is the last innocent white man in America. He doesn't make excuses in his novels for what we've done to ourselves in this century. Out of pain and disappointment, he makes jokes instead. These jokes turn on us and bite our hands or neck. When I'm not feeling that bad, it seems to me that Vonnegut is what America used to be and ought to be all about. A one-man bill of rights, a plain-spoken small-d Democrat, a Johnny Appleseed of decencies. Which makes him, of course, a stranger in this strange land of big money and puny hearts. No wonder in his novels he has to leave town, leave even Mother Earth for outer space, usually to his favorite alien planet, Tralfalmador. He needs Tralfalmadorians the way Garcia Marquez needs angels, and Toni Morrison needs ghosts, and Shakespeare needs clowns. There must be an alternative to what we have become, a loftier intelligence. Tralfamadorians show up briefly in Hocus Pocus, Vonnegut's latest. So do William F. Buckley Jr. and Malcolm Forbes and Elizabeth Taylor in various disguises. Vonnegut himself appears as a memorial fountain on the campus of an upstate New York college for the white dyslexic children of the filthy rich. But they are all bit players in the bigger drama of Eugene Debs Hartke, a Vietnam War hero who begins by teaching history at that college and who ends by teaching reading and writing to illiterate blacks and Hispanics in a prison very much like Attica, right across the valley from the college. There will be a revolution in this valley, and Eugene Debs Hartke, like Howard Campbell in Mother's Night, like Kilgore Trout in Jailbird, will be tried for treason. Hocus Pocus is so intricate that too much synopsis might spoil your appetite. But the big picture is that Japanese run our hospitals and prisons. Koreans own the New York Times. Italians own the St. Louis Cardinals. Neither the dyslexic children of the filthy rich nor the illiterate black and Hispanic jailbirds can read the writing on the wall. Eugene Debs Hartke, named for the great American labor leader, adds up the number of women he's loved and the number of men he's killed and comes to an identical body count. The novel itself is written on scraps of paper Hartke stuffs into his pockets like one of Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg stories. The college itself was started by someone who looks like Abraham Lincoln. When the jailbirds escape and cross the valley to attack the college, they skate on thin ice, as in Uncle Tom's Cabin. Once upon a time in this valley, they made the covered wagons used by the cannibalistic Donner Party. We actually meet Moby Dick's penis and a character named Norman Updike. Funny, yes, and prophetic, and fabulous too, as cunning as Aesop, as gloomy as Grimm. But Hocus Pocus is also rich and referential, a meditation on American history and literature, an essay on the end of innocence. For Vonnegut, the civil war between black and white is far from over, and the civil war between rich and poor has only begun. We're left with Hartke's definition of high art, making the most of the raw materials of futility. Out of these raw materials, Vonnegut has made the highest art, his best novel in years.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Albie Sachs is a white member of the African National Congress living in London. On the next Fresh Air, Sachs describes surviving the explosion meant to kill him, and he tells us what he just saw on his second trip back to South Africa. Also, reviving the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies composed by Carl Stalling. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.